Here in France, the floodwaters rising as the remnants of Tropical Storm Kirk dump biblical amounts of rain. But that's just a drop in the bucket compared to what the southeast of the United States faces. Hurricane Milton forcing the evacuation of 5.5 million Florida residents, with President Biden warning this could become the storm of the century. Even more dramatic is that Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas and beyond are still reeling from the U.S.'s deadliest storm since 2005, what with Hurricane Helen killing 230, causing untold destruction. Now is not the time for partisan politics. Or is it? Democrats accuse Republicans of mass disinformation campaigns about the rescue and cleanup effort from Helen. Donald Trump doubling down on accusations that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris funneled money to charities that help migrants. Just how much will Mother Nature be on the ballot November 5th? More broadly, there's a populist backlash on both sides of the Atlantic against carbon-cutting policies, policies that Hungary's Viktor Orban, France's Marine Le Pen, and Germany's far right all say punishes the pocketbooks of the middle classes while taking away individual freedoms. As we look at the weather outside the window here, we're asking what should be done and who is winning this argument. Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about Hurricane Milton and all that surrounds us. With us is Florida native Michael Finocchiaro. You're a digital transformation consultant from the Miami area. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
With us as well, Théodore Talon, doctoral researcher at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. You've co-authored several reports, on the environmental backlash that we've seen here in Europe. Most recently, fieldwork on how you get ordinary citizens to feel that, you know, green policies, the green transition is in their interest. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the invite.
Philippe Chalais, energy, a researcher at the Sapiens Institute think tank. Welcome back to the show.
Good evening. Thank you.
From Stanford, California, climate health advocate Hannah Hundahl. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And France 24's White House correspondent Fraser Jackson is in the U.S. Capitol. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you, Francois. Good to be with you.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24debate. Yeah, the steady rain began before daybreak in Tampa, Florida, home to more than 3.5 million, which hasn't seen a direct hit from a major hurricane in more than a century. As the sandbags go up around Tampa General Hospital, Florida, as well, there are the animals from the zoo evacuated. Florida residents heeding the call. This is the scene late Tuesday on the I-75 interstate highway that goes up the state's western coast. Fraser Jackson, just in the last minutes, we've heard a briefing given to the U.S. president and vice president.
Yeah, they've been continually in touch with their respective teams, including the director of Homeland Security. They've also been talking, of course, to the FEMA director and all of the other heads of the agencies which are overseeing this operation to try to mitigate the impacts of this storm, which President Biden is calling a once-in-a-century storm. Take a listen to what he said during that briefing.
Winds will be fierce at well over 100 miles per hour, with storm surges reaching up to 15 feet and up to 18 inches of rain. It's looking like the storm of the century, but I urge everyone in Hurricane Milton's path to follow all safety instructions as we head to the next 24 hours. It's a matter of literally a matter of life and death.
Insane 18 inches of rain then, a massive amount of rain. And we heard from the director of the National Weather Service just recently as well in the last couple of minutes, who said that it could take about a week for that water to drain away from Florida because of drainage issues. And the amount of water which could get pushed onto mainland Florida is actually quite devastating. The National Weather Service anticipating storm surges of between 10 to 15 feet which is enough to submerge or at least get up to the roofs of most single-story buildings. So you're getting some kind of idea of the devastation which could be wreaked upon that western part of Florida, a part of Florida which, of course, is used to having hurricanes and storms, but nothing in living memory, at least, this bad, if all the predictions do indeed come to pass.
And if we have, again, this just hammer this point home, the fact that these are back-to-back hurricanes, the cleanup far from over from Hurricane Helen. We can show you images released earlier this week by the Florida National Guard in the Tampa suburb of St. Petersburg. And the governor of Florida, Republican Ron DeSantis, echoing Joe Biden's words when it comes to the mortal danger that lies ahead.
You'd be wise to go to a shelter, ride it out, but rather than try to mess with that. And if there are a lot of people that do stay behind, I mean, unfortunately, there will be fatalities. Like, I don't think there's any way around it when you have storm surge that could be 10 feet. So you have time to do that. There's going to be people who stay behind who are going to be in distress. We are going to, working with the locals, we're going to conduct rescue operations. We will do that.
Michael Finocchiario, Floridians are used to this, or is this really exceptional even for your
family? I mean, I personally lived through two of them. My parents have been through several. It's not an uncommon occurrence, but the fact that we've got two in a row is pretty bad. We have also short memories, because if you back in 2022, Ian wrecked the West Coast and basically buried Fort Myers and wiped out the bridge to Sanibel Island. I was just talking to my dad yesterday. They had just repaired the bridge, and the hurricane is hitting less than 100 miles away from that area again.
And so we'll see how that bridge holds up.
We'll see if it holds up again, yeah.
And this is part of it, right, is how do you prepare for increased spells of intense weather?
Well, I've seen pictures of people literally strapping their house roofs down with straps. There was a funny picture on the net. Basically, you do sandbagging. You block your windows. But the best thing is to get out of the way. I mean, most people I've heard reports again from family members that the I-4 and the I-75 have been solid packed for the last 24 hours. People trying to get ahead of the storm,
out. Where are they going?
They're going to family in Georgia. They're going to Alabama. They're just getting to the northern parts of the state, but just getting out of the way of the storm. And it's been a bit unpredictable, because originally it was supposed to hit a bit further north towards Tampa. Now it's hitting closer to Sarasota, a little further south. But the best thing is, as the president, as the governor said, is to get out of the way. And this particular storm hit record levels before hitting landfall of less than 900 millibars of pressure, which is just unheard of in one of these storms.
There's only five categories of storms, Hannah Hundahl, but because we have in the last 10 years a number of storms that have exceeded 309 kilometers an hour, they're talking about instituting something called a Category 6. What does that tell you?
Is that climate change, unfortunately, is driving the increasing intensity of these storms. What we're seeing is that they're getting more powerful. It's actually not an issue with the frequency. It's the fact that a greater proportion of these storms are predicted to be Category 4 and 5, and we might even have to extend that range. So I think it's, unfortunately, a devastating situation. We have to think about how to help people on the ground, but we can't lose sight of the long-term question here, which is how do we actually get at climate change, which is in turn fueling these devastating impacts that we're seeing?
Yeah, again, it's that sort of that central question as we watch Hurricane Milton, Phoebe Chavez, is do you try to reverse it, or do you just try to, build better bridges?
I think that we invest today most of the money in what we call attenuation, that is in fact the reduction of the CO2 emission, whereas we invest finally only small amount of money in what we call adaptation. So adaptation is in fact to adapt to the change of the climate. And I think all these events, of course this one, shows that more and more probably Florida will be difficult to live in. But there are also other places in the world where we can finally adapt to the change of climate if we invest the money.
Are you writing off Florida?
I don't know, but of course, we can see not necessarily Florida, but we can see that some places in the world, especially small islands and so on, will be more and more difficult for people to live. And so when I speak about adaptation, is that effectively the distribution of people all around the world has to be reviewed according to this data. We can see this is the fact that effectively in most of islands, for instance, people are afraid because of the increase of the water level and so on. However, I'm relatively optimistic, and I think that we can defend against the excessive climate. If I ask you, what would be the first country in Europe that should be flooded? What would you answer?
The first one that's susceptible to floods?
Yeah.
Well, I might say a country like Ireland a country like
Holland.
Yeah.
There is never flooding in Holland because they have adapted to the climate for practically 500 years. So a big message, I think, and it's not really understood by the politics today, is to reduce the investment in attenuation and increase the investment in adaptation. It's absolutely, for me, a key for the future because the climate has changed already and we have to adapt to these changes.
Théodore Talon?
So just a note on this, I don't think we need to reduce investment in mitigation. We need to put way more money into mitigation and prepare.
Yes,
we will need to adapt. But I agree that we need to adapt to climate change, but I think we need to be very careful, especially for our viewers, to make the claim that we can basically just protect ourselves from the effect of climate change. We see that, the Netherlands has done something regarding climate. It's not actually even regarding climate change, that they prepared, like they defend themselves from floods. But I think we need to be very careful in saying that basically what's going to happen to Florida, it's okay, we just need to build higher houses, we just need to protect each other, and we need to protect our buildings from climate change. I think this is not what's going to happen. I think some places are not going to be possible anymore to live in, and we're just going to have to mitigate as much as possible the effect of climate change and residually adapt when there is no other options, when we can't move all population, for example, around.
And we have places like Miami Beach, which have their feet in the water, we might say.
A lot of the coast of Florida has been overdeveloped over the last couple decades, and you have a lot of real estate, valuable real estate, right, that is waterfront, that will it's in danger to these storms.
And yet the population's increasing and those real estate prices are rising.
Because people want the sun. They want to, there's been a migration into Florida for several decades. The winter birds, the people coming down from New York for the wintertime, people retiring because there's no state income tax, which also means there's a lot of people coming in. So that there's always a lot of people coming in to the state due to this migration. But unfortunately, that puts a lot of pressure on real estate, and when people start moving next to the coast, then the development goes kind of crazy. You have to remember, too, that we've overdeveloped to the point where we started draining the Everglades, which was one of our greatest resources of water. The Army Corps of Engineers was supposed to manage that. The water level is way down, which means the water table is going down, which creates even more problems for managing these growing populations. And it's really tough to win in this.
Hannah Hundahl, you heard earlier in the discussion Michael saying how people have forgotten 2022. Is this a problem of partisan policy, or is it just a problem of human nature that we're talking about?
Well, I would go a step further. I would argue that people have, in some ways, even forgotten 2005. So next year will be the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which was one of the largest, costliest, deadliest disasters to ever hit the United States, had ramifications that are still being felt to this day by people who had to leave that region, people who lost family members, people who lost their businesses. I mean, those were indelible impacts in that community. And it'll be 20 years next year. And sometimes we do, I think, have to pause and reflect on what have we actually learned in terms of preparedness for these disasters. So I would argue that our amnesia over some of these events might even extend further.
Let's go back to the history books, not as far as 2005. Remember, today's October 9th. We're less than a month away from the U.S. presidential election. And it's not the first time that Mother Nature has invited herself into the home stretch of a presidential race. Back in 2012, when Superstorm Sandy battered the northeast of the United States, New Jersey's Republican governor and incumbent President Barack Obama put aside partisan differences days before Obama was reelected for a second term. Christie praised the president as outstanding in his support. Are you expecting Michael Finocchiaro, a photo op involving Joe Biden and the Republican governor of Florida?
You might. I mean, you've seen the on October 7th, DeSantis was still saying that he was going to refuse federal aid. He didn't need it. And then yesterday morning, he said he's talked to Joe Biden. He's going to accept the aid and they're going to come to things. So I think that given that the other Republican governors have all accepted aid for Helen, he doesn't really have a choice and that he'll probably do the photo op, although it might be a bit reluctant. I don't see them doing a photo op with Trump over this, though, that's for sure.
And we won't see a photo op with Trump, probably. That's because it's become, well, a central campaign issue. Donald Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance, doubling down on claims that Democrats say are outright lies. In a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece this Wednesday, the vice presidential candidate claiming that under Harris and Biden, FEMA has funneled millions of dollars to non-governmental organizations whose stated goal is facilitating mass migration into the U.S. More on that with Vidika Bahel.
Donald Trump isn't just ramping up his presidential campaign. He's also amplifying a series of falsehoods and misinformation about the government's hurricane response. In both Michigan and North Carolina, he incorrectly accused the White House of stealing $1 billion from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to house undocumented immigrants.
Some of them are murderers, some of them are drug dealers. 13,099 murderers came into our country during their 3.5, and we're missing $1 billion they gave them to the migrants that came in.
Though FEMA has a different budget for shelter and support services for immigrants, its funding for disaster relief is ring-fenced. And the agency's director has squashed the lie, saying FEMA has what it needs. The last time U.S. disaster relief funds were reallocated for immigration purposes was, in fact, in 2019 under Trump himself, to bolster migrant programs at the southern border. Later, Trump suggested victims who lost their homes would only receive $750 in federal aid.
They send hundreds of billions of dollars to foreign nations, and you know what they're giving our people? $750.
But the $750 is designed for immediate relief for essential supplies. It's only part of a larger aid package to those devastated by the storm. The maximum amount of home repair assistance available to survivors is $42,500. His latest false claim accuses Vice President Harris of driving her campaign efforts whilst neglecting helicopters and rescue in North Carolina. Though this was quickly debunked by the state's Department of Public Safety, which says operations are ongoing with over 1,600 personnel involved. Harris, for her part, has slammed her opponent as incredibly irresponsible for spreading falsehoods about the federal response, as just weeks remain till Election Day.
Fraser Jackson, are Donald Trump's claims, which you saw in that report, have been pushed back upon by interested parties. Are they sticking in the minds of voters?
Well, I think it's hard to tell at the moment because, you know, especially polling, it takes a while for these kind of things to shake out in polls and stuff. And, you know, a lot of the stuff you see on Twitter, it's kind of hard to take a temperature, really, because there is such a flood of misinformation and disinformation on Twitter at the moment that it's hard to really get a handle on how these kind of policies will play out and the lies rather will play out as well. I think it like most things in American culture and politics, it will end up depending on what party you're in as to what you believe. But the Biden administration is working hard to push back upon the narratives being pushed forward by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance in particular. And Joe Biden spoke about that at a briefing just a short while ago. Take a listen to what his reaction was to these words by Donald Trump.
Well, the last few weeks, there's been a reckless, irresponsible, and relentless promotion of disinformation and outright lies that are disturbing people. It's undermining confidence in the incredible rescue and recovery work that has already been taken and will continue to be taken. And it's harmful to those who need help the most. There is simply no place for this to happen. Former President Trump has led the onslaught of lies. Assertions have been made that property is being confiscated. That's simply not true.
So an onslaught of lies there that Joe Biden called reckless and irresponsible. Of course, one of those lies being that the Biden administration has redirected money from FEMA to give to undocumented migrants. But one of the fact-checking websites, which is relatively popular here in the United States, released an article a couple of days ago, which actually showed that Donald Trump himself was guilty of doing just that during his time in office, which Democrats are using as a bit of a weapon against him. During his time in office, Donald Trump diverted around $155 million from FEMA to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. They're both under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security. And that was money that was then used to put towards the temporary creation of immigration hearing facilities along the southern border. So Donald Trump being accused of hypocrisy by Democrats, the Republicans pushing back against that, of course, and saying that this has been one of the worst handled disasters in U.S. history. So again, a very partisan subject here at a time when a lot of politicians who are not in the main spotlight are calling for bipartisanship.
Yeah, the U.S. president canceled a trip to Europe to stay for Hurricane Milton, Theodore Talon. And that's probably because everybody has in mind George W. Bush in 2005, and the fact that he was seen to be a bit aloof in his handling of Hurricane Katrina, politically he suffered. What's your reaction when you see this tit for tat between Democrats and Republicans right now?
So I'm not going to try to comment on your interesting American politics. I'm more going to try to focus on what social science can tell us regarding the sort of impact this can have electorally, because I think this is what we're interested in. There has been a lot of research in social sciences trying to understand potentially what could be the impact of those sort of storms and potential political conflicts around natural disasters. And what is very tricky for me to say is that there is very mixed evidence that this has actually an impact in favor of one or the two teams, because that very much depends on what's going to happen. So I very much agree with Fraser. It's going to be very hard to understand how this is going to unfold right now, because we have examples of 2012 with Obama, with 2005. But today, with such a polarizing political scene, I think what is very likely is that Democrats are going to stick to the narrative of the Democrats and Republicans are going to stick to the narrative of the Republicans. And I think at the end of the day, what we saw in a study 1 or 2 years ago was that natural disasters tend to create more climate consciousness among Democrats, but not among Republicans. And it tends to create more support for actions among those who already believe that there is climate change and that there is a problem in terms of climate, the impact of climate change, and isn't going to lead to a real impact in terms of those who think that climate change is not really a reality. And I think that's a very important information to get it in our head.
Why does everyone stay in their lane?
Because climate politics is becoming so polarized that in a way, if you don't believe in climate change, weirdly, there is sort of a psychological defense where you're going to stick to your ideological beliefs, which is I'm a Republican and I don't believe in climate change. Some Republicans do believe in climate change. But if you don't, you're going to stick to your belief that is very rooted. It's something that you've been believing for decades. And you're not going to suddenly switch. Whereas if you're on the other side and you think that there is a problem, this might actually increase the saliency of this in your brain. You're going to be like, okay, there is a problem, and the problem is potentially even more significant than what I thought before. And I think it's sort of a defense mechanism, right? It's like, you don't believe it's happening, so you just try to keep it at arm's length. Whereas if you do believe that it's happening, you're going to follow potentially some other elite cues telling you, okay, there is something happening, we need to act on this issue. And I think this is what's going to happen, sadly. I don't expect massive changes in voting in Florida, Georgia, North Carolina in terms of Republican climate skeptics.
And yet, these two echo chambers, these two bubbles, Michael Finocchiaro, remember, there were Republican candidates for president who very much believed in climate change. John McCain, Mitt Romney, recently.
Yeah, I think that the problem is that we're always trying to blame the problems on somebody else. Like we're looking at climate change and we're thinking immigration instead of thinking climate change. We're just to his point, I think that there's this buy-in, like the people bought into the Trump thing, and they're not going to let go of those beliefs because they've been holding on to this for 5 or 6 years now. Even in spite of the facts where we are seeing issues. At the same time, the Democrats are also going to be are kind of dug into their position as well. So the problem in the U.S., we really have this fracture, this sort of undeclared civil war between these two points of view that really have a hard time coming across and being able to agree with each other.
Because here we're talking about disaster preparedness and disaster relief, mitigation for disasters, as you were saying earlier, Philippe Chalais. But it's not just about extreme weather. It's also about the green transition. Donald Trump's repeatedly warned voters that the government's going to take away their combustion engine cars and trucks and replace them with electric vehicles. On its editorial pages, the Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal warning of an EV backlash in swing state Michigan, the historical home of U.S. auto manufacturing. At a rally in Flint, Michigan late last week, Kamala Harris responding.
Be clear, contrary to what my opponent is suggesting, I will never tell you what kind of car you have to drive. But here's what I will do. I will invest in communities like Flint. Flint, which helped build the auto industry and the UAW.
The UAW, the Auto Workers Union. Hannah Hundahl, in light of what you just heard Theodore Talon say, how effective is Kamala Harris's messaging on these issues?
Yeah, so a couple of points to reply to everything that's been said. I think, first of all, this is par for the course for Donald Trump to sort of create a circus out of a situation like this. You know, oftentimes it really gets him out there in the media, and he's a master at earning free media. And that helps boost him, unfortunately, politically. We also know that he tends to poll really well on immigration. And so, of course, he's going to try to distort this issue, the disaster relief efforts, into some type of immigration-related issue, because that plays well into his hand, right? I think also, you know, at this point in time, although I agree with the assessment that the way that people are going to end up voting, whether they see this as an issue centrally of climate change or not, is probably calcified, I think whether people are actually going to be able to get to the polls might be the key player in this situation. We've seen the devastation, for example, in Asheville, North Carolina after Hurricane Helene. For those folks, it can be incredibly hard to even get to the polls on Election Day or even figure out the situation around mail-in voting. So I think that might actually end up coming into play. Final point, I think Kamala Harris, there's been some talk of her sort of shying away from the really robust Biden-Harris climate record because of some concerns around her previous positions on fracking. So priorly, she came out against fracking in the election before when she was actually running against President Biden for the nomination in 2020. Now it seems she sort of tried to walk that position back a bit. And there's been some discussion that kind of the trepidations around that has made her shy away from talking about climate change at all. I think these events in the past 2 weeks, Hurricane Helene and now Hurricane Milton, are actually going to open that window for her to be able to reclaim her leadership on this issue in a way that actually resonates with most Americans and certainly with Democrats.
Climate policy can be a winner for Kamala Harris, Philippe Chalais?
I think so. But there is also a problem of time, I would say, between effectively, again, mitigation of climate with CO2 and adaptation. Mitigation is very long. We know that the tons of carbon we avoid today will have an effect in 50 years.
But we've seen this ambitious energy transition policy in the United States.
This ambitious energy transition currently is a disaster. 10 years after the COP21, we continue to see the global world emission increasing. And the problem is that the emission have no boundary, no frontier. In fact, if globally, we don't decrease the emission. The effect is unfortunately...
But this battle over this switch to electric vehicles?
Yeah. Alors, the switch to electric vehicles, of course, could be interesting if we do it very quickly. But we can see today that, especially in Europe, it's relatively a disaster. We can see that it's too expensive. We can see that it's not very practical. And so, in fact, it doesn't work very well. It's the reason why, again, I think that we need to reallocate the funds, because I agree with you that we have to increase the funds, but the funds, unfortunately, are not infinite. So we have to make choice and to make some allocation. And again, for me, we know today that the 1.5 degree is far from reality, that we go to 2.7 degree, and so again, adaptation. Alors, I understand that adapting to such a big storm is extremely difficult, but I think that in many cases...
But cutting carbon emissions? Are you saying you should do both?
I think that we should, again, reallocate funds from... carbon reduction to adaptation.
Théodore Talon.
So, just to be clear, there is no science saying we should do this. The science is saying we should invest as much money as possible, as quickly as possible on carbon on mitigation of climate change because there is no other choice. And we can't adapt to a world where there is on average 3 to 4 degrees temperature increase. It's just not possible. We can't have a storm like this every 2, 3, 4 years. We can't have floods happening every 2 years, because that's what we're talking about. The sort of floods we have in Europe that can be devastating, this is going to be every year or every 2 years. So this is impossible to adapt to this sort of catastrophes. We will have to adapt because climate change is already there. So there are some impacts we need to adapt to, but we need to invest as much money in mitigation, but also invest it properly. It's not because right now we are struggling to manage the transition to e-vehicles. And that's true. Michigan is a good example. I have some colleagues doing research in Michigan showing that the transition to electric vehicles has had a political impact, because some workers decided to switch from Democrats to Republicans because they were losing their jobs. But that's not because of electric vehicles. That's because it's the transition that wasn't done with the proper mitigation strategies, mitigation in the sense, you know, compensatory measures, training programs for workers. And we have evidence in social sciences showing that if we don't do the green transition well, it's true that Kamala Harris, green parties in Europe, social democrats are going to suffer major losses, because it's going to, you know, create some resentment from potential workers or people impacted by low emission zones, carbon taxes. But there is also evidence that if we do it well, if we do just transition plan for workers, if we include communities, if we invest in making e-vehicles cheaper, for instance, and making fossil fuels cars a bit more expensive, if we invest in subsidizing solar panels or wind farms, it's possible to create policy support.
As it stands right now, Hannah Hundahl, is it true that people from the middle classes are paying a high cost when they're told to change their boiler, when they're told to buy an electric vehicle?
Well, I think actually one of the issues is the way that we have framed the impacts of climate change. I think we really need to do a better job in terms of framing it around the public health impacts. So look at what's happened in the case of Hurricane Helene, and now in the preparations for Hurricane Milton. You have power outages, for example. Power outages can actually be a death sentence for people who need to refrigerate their medications, for people who rely on medical devices. We also see the impacts of flooding leading to greater transmission of waterborne diseases, raising the specter for vector-borne diseases, injuries, how emergency departments become inundated and strained to their breaking points. I think these are the types of impacts that we have to highlight, because unfortunately, we kind of sometimes get mired in the economic questions, which is, you know, sometimes we don't quite have all
the bearings. But we're in an election cycle, Hannah, where there's been inflation, the likes of which hasn't been seen in several decades. And what we're talking about costs money up front.
It costs money up front, but we need to make that case better, because unfortunately, the case that I think we've made up until now is just that, in fact, that it's money up front without actually looking at the benefits, both in the short term and the long term, in terms of economics and public health, which are two very important issues that people across the political spectrum agree on.
Michael Finocchiario, your thoughts on this? Here in Europe, we've been grappling with industrial policy for decades. Americans came in and did it with this Inflation Reduction Act and investments for homegrown technologies. So, and yet it does, it seems as though there's a question of whether or not it's going to backfire at the ballot box.
Yeah, I think it's pretty complex, and I think another issue around like electric vehicles are great, but they're also using a lot of hazardous chemicals, and recycling the batteries costs a lot. I think it's a little more complicated. I think a lot of this investment, particularly the problem I think in the U.S. is no investment at all in public transportation. Right? There's no train system to speak of. I think that's one of the things that probably helps us in Europe, the fact that we do have public transportation and that people can get from one country to another without taking an airplane or without driving, and that's a pretty major impact on climate change as well. And that's something the U.S. is just incapable of doing because they've never, every time that an issue has come up for having a national train system, an investment there, it's been voted down because people just don't see the benefit of it, and people are tied to their cars.
So the pushback against the green transition has boosted the far right in France. It's boosted the far right in Germany. Hungary's leader Viktor Orban, who holds the rotating presidency of the European Council, this Wednesday, using the pulpit at the European Parliament for his you get one speech before the European lawmakers when your country holds that presidency. It was today. He says the decision to slap tariffs on subsidized Chinese EV imports was wrong, for instance.
One of the best examples of a lack of planning in the EU is that climate policy is being applied without industrial policy. That means we're applying climate policy where there isn't any industrial policy. However, the EU hasn't incentivized the transformation of supply chains. Therefore, EU companies have lost significant market shares, and if we move towards trade restrictions, and such plans exist, then I think that we will lose even more market share.
Philippe Charles, Your thoughts on that?
I think I wrote a paper a few months ago about this new taxes about Chinese electric vehicle. When you look at it, it could be a good idea, but the
Chinese heavily subsidized there.
I know, but the problem is that who will pay this increase of price? Not the Chinese. It will be the European paying the tax because the price of the car will increase. And so what will happen? You will sell less electric car because finally, what's the goal? The goal is to move the price of the electric car, the Chinese electric car, at approximately, if I understand, the same level as the European electric car. But we know today that your European electric car are too expensive, and this is one of the reasons for which I think in 1 year, practically 40% of decrease in selling electric car because too expensive, not very practical, not enough charging plugs in big towns like Paris. So extremely difficult. So I don't think it will solve the problem.
Théodore Talon, based on your research, how much of is Viktor Orban's view a minority view in Europe?
So it depends which sort of views, because what is interesting with these sort of politicians, they are the ones not applying climate policy at home. We know radical right politicians are actually the enemies of climate action because we have evidence regarding this. We know they don't support climate policy at the European level. His party doesn't support the Green Deal, the European Green Deal. But then suddenly he's starting to say that we need to invest more in industrial the facilities to produce the green technologies. But now the EU agrees on this. I think now the new EU Commission is trying to be structured around industrial policy. And actually everything is becoming now about being competitive, having green technologies that are cheaper and made in Europe. So I think there is this turn in Europe that we see. So in this sense, he's quite right. And I think potentially we could agree with him that if we don't have the facilities to produce e-vehicles, we're just going to lose the green battles. But I think what I just found a bit silly is that he's the one also forbidding us to actually implement more stringent climate policies. But I think if the EU does it right, which means increasing tariffs on Chinese vehicles, but subsidizing vehicles made in Europe, subsidizing facilities, helping workers being trained, spending money to support individuals to buy e-vehicles, and then maybe subsidizing green technologies, etc., and helping also local authorities to maybe invest in, you know, sort of leasing where you can get a car for 1 or 2 days. So I think there are many policies that we could imagine that would make e-vehicles cheaper. Of course, they are not the only solution to mobility, and they are not the only solution to climate change, because there is also, we have to talk about housing, we have to talk about energy, etc. But I think there are many ways to decarbonize mobility. We just need more investment and in a coordinated way.
However, don't forget that electric vehicle decarbonize, providing the electricity is decarbonized, which is not the case. In Germany, if you make a calculation, it's much better currently, to use a thermal car than an electric car, because balance is completely ridiculous.
This is not true. For most German citizens, because they use their car a lot, after several years, even in Germany, it's going to be more beneficial for climate.
No, that's not true, because of the electricity.
All right, disagreement on that. We're running short on time. Very briefly, Henna Hundal, back in 2016, when Donald Trump was first running for president, he had 3 debates with Hillary Clinton. I think the environment was not brought up once, if I'm not mistaken. At least it is a campaign issue. Just in a word, how much of a campaign issue is it?
I think it's going to be more of a campaign issue in light of the devastating effects of Hurricane Helene and Hurricane Milton. And here's why. At the vice presidential debate last week between Senator J.D. Vance and Governor Tim Walz, one of the very first questions that was posed to them was actually about Hurricane Helene and climate change. And it was a dual question. And it was so interesting to watch the way in which J.D. Vance had to sort of tap dance around that question. First, of course, extending sincere sympathies to the victims of Hurricane Helene, and then sort of separately trying to address the climate change question. I think Democrats have a real opportunity here to recognize the actual marriage of those two topics and refine messaging around that to really target key voters.
Michael Finocchiari, of course, right now it's all about, in your home state of Florida, keeping people safe and out of the way of harm.
Yeah, I just hope that the damage will be minimum, especially the human toll. I think that the real danger, though, in some of the discourses coming from the right is some of the anti-Semitic stuff is coming, because they've been talking about, some of the crazier politicians said that the other people are modifying the weather and it's the fault of they. And this they is very vague and it's been interpreted as an anti-Semitic message. So I just hope that people can calm down the messaging, the partisanship, this partisan messaging that becomes really violent and has nothing to do with the problem at hand and climate change, and yet they try to turn it onto something else.
You cannot blame the weather on human beings. We'll leave it at that. Michael Finocchiari, I want to thank you. I want to for coming in. I want to thank Theodore Talon, Philippe Chavez. I want to thank as well Henna Hundal for being with us from Stanford. Fraser Jackson, our correspondent in Washington. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24.